I don't think we need to always go to technology on some of this. This is really about health, and this whole discussion around weight is we really care about how weight is affecting health and happiness.
Are you raising a family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Or do you ask, where's the roadmap to building a happy, healthy life? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah, the podcast that helps parents navigate this incredible journey of raising healthy, resilient kids. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Adams, and today we're tackling a topic that so many families have questions about, pediatric obesity. This is a conversation not about shame or numbers on a scale, but about understanding growth, health, and how we can support our children in developing lifelong healthy habits. I'm truly honored to welcome my guest today, Dr. Christopher Bowling. He is a national leader in the prevention and treatment of childhood obesity. He has helped shape national policies on healthy active living and has co-authored the American Academy of Pediatrics Clinical Practice Guidelines on Obesity. Dr. Bowling, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here. I always love talking with you, so this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, so I was telling my staff that I listened to a lecture recently that you gave for pediatric providers, and I was inspired to have you speak so that parents can hear more about how they can help their children live a healthy, active life. And so many parents hear about BMI at the doctor's office. Can you start by explaining what BMI is and how it's used in pediatrics?
Absolutely. You know, I think you and I have sort of the same mission here, Sarah, and that's making things doable for pediatricians in the office and making them be able to be effective with their families so that they can do things that actually really help their families. BMI is one of those things too. People can really get caught up on it because it's a number. It's something that we've used it to define a lot of things that we probably shouldn't have been using it for over the years. So, you know, it's a vital sign. BMI is a vital sign like other vital signs, like pulse, blood pressure, respiratory rate. And it's a number that we need to look at in context with what's going on with the patient. So for some patients, BMI, which we know is a calculation basically of just weight and height. For some patients, that a higher BMI is a signal of high muscle content. So it doesn't necessarily say anything about body composition. So it's got limitations. The unfortunate thing is we don't have a lot of other options right now. Mm-hmm. So like other vital signs, you know, a low heart rate might be a sign of a highly conditioned athlete, or it might be a sign of heart block.
Right.
So the same number for a different patient can mean something completely different. It's exactly the same way with BMI. So it's a number. It's something that we don't have a lot of other great, easily obtainable ways to quantify body composition yet in the office. So we use BMI, and it's a decent proxy for body composition for most patients, but not for all patients.
And you bring up such a good point, because if it's just one vital sign, and I love that you use it that way, and I want people that are listening to realize it's just one little piece of the puzzle, right? What are some other signs that might indicate a child is at risk for an obesity-related health issue other than the BMI?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of other indications, and certainly there are some physical metrics that we look at that some people will say, like, you know, waist circumference can be helpful, or use of other techniques to measure body composition. But I think it's more basic than that, honestly. I don't think we need to always go to technology on some of this. This is really about health. And this whole discussion around weight is we really care about how weight is affecting health and happiness. So if we notice that people are, you know, our patients are not happy with their weight, if patients are struggling because of their weight, they're out of breath, they're not able to do the things they want to do, that life is becoming difficult for them because of their weight, for whatever reason, then it's an issue. So, you know, can you have a higher BMI and be healthy and happy? Absolutely. But we also want to make sure of those things. Sometimes weight can trigger other health issues. And as physicians, as medical caregivers, we are obligated to really look for those causes and those problems that might be happening for our patients.
When should parents actually be concerned about their child's weight? So let's say they're 95th percentile for height, 95th percentile for weight, and their BMI is in that kind of yellow zone, so to speak. And you brought up some good points already, but I think that it's such a sensitive issue, isn't it? Because I know sometimes in my office, they come in and I don't want to shock them because they look at me like, well, he looks great, you know, or at the other end there, it can be obvious in some cases. And in some cases, like you said, their body composition could be very muscular. So when do they worry?
Well, we are notoriously bad at just looking at people and saying like, oh, your weight is not at an optimal zone. We're terrible at it. Parents are terrible at it. Pediatricians are terrible at it. We're terrible at it when we look at ourselves in the mirror. You know, I think it's the root of a lot of eating disorders and other things. We're just really bad at it. So the BMI, the other factors can be a clue that there may be something going on. And certainly we use certain parameters to say, you know, it's time to look for other things that weight might be causing a problem. You know, we can say that the degree to which overweight and or obesity is present also is a bit of a predictor. So, you know, you can say to a family like, I know everything feels great right now, but I'm a little worried about where we are currently on the growth chart, because we know that people at this level or that level, and I don't mean to say exactly which levels because it's different for every patient.
Right.
But we know that you'll be at risk for things later in life or at risk for things right now. So it's like, I think it's really important to use hard data like the BMI, but also other hard data that we might get, you know, like an elevation in liver function tests or high blood pressure or inability, certain other diagnoses that we see, you know, leg pain, back pain, sleep problems that may be occurring that may be weight related. Okay. So I think we're just notoriously bad at it. And we need to depend on what our patient is saying and kind of what our clinical skills are saying too.
How do pediatricians and even parents partner with their kids to approach this topic with compassion and not shame?
That is so challenging. And I think, you know, this is the challenge and the reward of parenting. You know, how do I get through to my kids? How do I let them know that I'm there to help them? How do we have those difficult conversations? And boy, they don't get any more difficult than those conversations around weight. Oh, they're just so hard. I feel for parents. I always felt like as a pediatrician, my role is, you know, telling parents, you're doing a good job. This is hard. This is just tough for everybody. And it's really tough around weight issues. You know, and I think parents are really very, rightly so, are very concerned. Are we going to, am I going to trigger a weight, an eating disorder by bringing up these issues around weight? I'm really worried about them, but how do I do that? And I think, you know, there's some things that we as pediatricians can do and things that parents can do the same thing. It's not, I'm a big proponent, as you know, of motivational interviewing.
Yes.
And yeah, I don't think you have to know motivational interviewing. I think a lot of times motivational interviewing just gives titles to things that we know are good communication habits, like listening more than talking, you know, really hearing, is this an issue for my child in the first place? Do they even care about it? But really paying attention, like listening to those unspoken kind of communication too. Like, are they self-conscious about how they look? Are they withdrawing socially? Are there things that are happening that are bothering them? And we need to really be in tune with that. The other thing that I think is important, aside from, you know, like listening more than talking, I think we also need to really be asking open questions. You know, it's like kids know very quickly where, you know, if we're going like, do you really need to eat that kind of comment?
Oh,
kids
yeah.
know very quickly what that means. And they'll say, you know, quit weight shaming me, Mom.
I know.
You know, so it's, we need to be more open in our questions. Like, hey, what's going on? What are we doing today? Or what are things that, you know, are on the child's mind and maybe not a direct, that direct challenge over food, over exercise, over those good habits. We know kids, that's their way that they express independence, is by sort of battling back against what we tell them. So I think it's important to maybe deflect a little bit more and to be a good listener.
So for those that are listening, will you describe what motivational interviewing actually is?
Sure. I'm fascinated by it. I got exposed to it probably 20 years ago and have just loved it ever since. It's a counseling technique that actually grew out of the substance abuse research areas, a fascinating topic where you are trying to identify with your patient, your spouse, whoever it may be, rather than butting up against them and trying to counsel them into something or advise them into something. What you're trying to do is you're trying to understand them first. We talk about there being four pillars. The first pillar being an engagement where you try to understand what's going on. And then you sort of identify what might be a behavior change that might be helpful jointly with them. It's very collaborative. It's like you're not enforcing your will on them. You're not trying to convince them of your position. You're trying to find out what's important to them. And, you know, for most people, being healthy is an important topic. So you can usually find some common ground. And then what you do is you evoke from inside them what might be the motivation for that change. You know, like figuring out what is it about this behavior that would make them want to adopt it. You know, I do want to be healthier. I do want to go hike the Appalachian Trail, or I do want to do something different about this. And then the last step in this is really collaboratively and together formulating a plan how to accomplish it. So it's a very collaborative, it's a very empathic sort of approach where you're actually listening to people first before you just launch into, you need to stop smoking, you need to do this, you need to do that.
And it sounds to me like a technique, because I reflect back on even my own childhood where my mom would, you know, I would be wearing something and it just like popped into my head. And I know we're talking about not just diet and so on, but, you know, that body image, that appearance. And I remember my mom saying to me, like, you can't wear that shirt because of your size. It's got stripes that are going, you know, horizontally. And that stuck with me even now. And, you know, and so it's more like what I hear you saying with this motivational is, how do we work together so that we don't create this shame, this change in body image? Because I can reflect back on a colleague of mine, and they felt so bad because they brought up this, you know, about this child's weight, 12-year-old girl. And then what ended up happening is they came to see me. They were actually my patient, but they saw another physician, which I was so grateful for. But then the little girl said to me, well, I never thought I was overweight until they said something. And now I feel really bad about myself. So body image is something that both boys and girls struggle with. How do we help them? I mean, I think this motivational interviewing and collaborating sounds like a really good way to work with families so that we don't all of a sudden, it's like those sensitive topics, so that all of a sudden they're not just immediately thinking something's wrong with me.
Right. This is a really complicated topic, you know, and I think that all of work with weight management is incredibly complicated. Multiple organ systems, multiple things going on. And this area around eating disorders is one of the most complicated. It's really, really a tough zone to approach. What I would first say is, you know, I think your experience of remembering the horizontal stripes, you know, we have those. Kids remember that. I think it's one of the things that makes parenting so scary is like, I'm going to say what my parents said to me that I never completely gotten over when my dad told me that, you know. So I think that it's nerve-wracking to think you're going to say the wrong thing. And we have to give ourselves, parents, some grace. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to say the wrong thing. We're just going to screw up. We're going to do it. So, you know, all you have to do is you just have to ask for a lot of forgiveness. But I also think when we talk about eating disorders, I think it's very important that we keep the focus on why we're bringing this up. We care about this because of health. Mm-hmm. Kids are beautiful. Kids are great. Kids are who they are. We, you know, you and I are pediatricians because we just love that optimism of kids. I mean, they're wonderful. Mm-hmm. And we want to preserve that. They're beautiful people. We want them to be very confident people. So we keep the focus. And I think it's really important to keep the focus on health all the time. This is about health. This isn't about looking like a celebrity. This isn't about some other sort of body image that it doesn't fit their genetics. It doesn't fit their who they are. It's just not who they are.
Yeah.
And I think that it is, you know, society pushes one image of what we should look like. And so we really need to get away from that image driven viewpoint and keep it on health. I always loved a comment. I don't know if you know Fatima Cody Stanford. She is an obesity specialist at Harvard, and I love her. She's great. She's been on the obesity section at the American Academy of Pediatrics with me. And Fatima had the comment. She said, you know, her goal when she meets with a patient who she runs a weight management center, and she said her goal with the family, and she states it first and foremost, is for us to find the weight status that makes you the happiest and healthiest. Mm. And I'm like, that's a really good way of saying it. It's those two things together. It's not only about health. It's not only about happiness. It's about both of those things together. And it's a joint decision. What's going to be best for that family and that patient.
Hey everyone, if you're liking this conversation, will you please help us grow by subscribing to the show here on YouTube and liking the episode so that it reaches other parents? And there are other ways to engage with us here on Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. Follow me on Instagram and you can reach out and leave me a voice memo or message. The email's in the description box below. Now back to our conversation. Stick around for more really good information. And that is so true, because I know I get questions, and I'm sure there's people listening right now who have asked me, what weight should my child be? And I always say, like,
oh yeah,
that I'm not going to give you that. It's not about the number, right? So I love what she said about being happy and healthy, and how the two it's versus really working towards an actual number.
Well, you know, I'm guilty of this myself. I think there are a lot of us who are in the obesity world who have a personal history with weight loss. And I am always number focused. Like, I want to be in this range. I want to be at that range. I want to be this. I want to be that. And I'm like, it really is. It's, you know what? It's like, you can't get that little bug out of your head, can you? You just are always fighting it.
It is true.
And it's just how we're wired sometimes. And again, I think it's about giving grace to that, but saying what it is. It's really not about a number. It really, truly isn't. I mean, here I am, you know, I'm in my mid 60s and I'm still fighting that same thing. Like, okay, it's really not about the number, but boy, I really want to make sure I'm in that zone. You know, geez, it doesn't ever end. So I think we just really have to work at it. And I think it's important for us to state that, I mean, I think we're probably damaged goods. We're never going to be able to get over it. So maybe our, maybe the younger generation, if we start the conversation a little earlier and say like, you know, this really is not about a number. This is really about you being happy and healthy. Maybe we'll, maybe the next generation will be better about it with them.
And you bring up a good point. Let's talk about that. You said younger, like at what age, what developmental stage do you think it's important to really start having these conversations as a family?
Well, you know, we know, I think one of the things that I think is really fascinating about this topic, and I alluded to it, is I really battle against reductive thinking with obesity because it is so complicated. We know that issues with weight start in utero. I mean, you know, it's your genetic makeup, it is your maternal factors, it's all sorts of stuff influence things from a very, I mean, before we're born, you know, so it, all these things are really have a big impact. So it's very complicated, but we start, and the really the message, I think, from our clinical report on healthy active living that we just released a few months back, is really like you start right away. You start with newborns. You know, it's about introduction of solids. It's about promotion of breastfeeding. So I think we start early, early on. Now, actual weight management strategies, I mean, sometimes your hand is forced, at, you know, at a very young age. I mean, I think you and I have both seen patients who have, who struggle with severe obesity at age 4. So it can be really heartbreaking and really tough. But we know that there are things that can affect patients at a very, very young age. But I think from a prevention, from a promotion of healthy active living, that starts right out of the gate.
And I think that what we need to remind everyone is it is that babies are born with that innate ability to understand, I eat when I'm hungry and I stop when I'm full. And I know you mentioned like we're far gone because somewhere along the way, people, children, adults lose that concept, you know, of just stopping when we've had enough versus like eating too much. And babies are so good at that. And I remember sitting with my husband and my nephew, who was 5 at the time, and he was done. And I said, is your tummy happy? And he said, yes. And my husband was like, well, you need to finish your food. And I let him leave the table. And I looked at him, I said, you know, this is what it's all about. It's about really letting them understand their hunger cues. Now, don't get me wrong. Like he actually had eaten some and it wasn't like he was leaving for, you know, it was a behavior thing. There's like you said, it's so complicated, right? But the key here is really working with our kids and letting them eat when they're hungry and stopping when they're full.
So I don't know if you have this battle too. I have this, you know, we're both victims of the clean plate club.
Yes.
Period of parenting. And it still exists today, you know. And I also have this struggle that I always go back and forth. I hate food waste. I hate it. It drives me crazy. It's terrible. But I also, you know, you also know that it is about with kids, as you said, kids are born with a regulation on this and we do things to overpower it. You know, one of the things that I think is so, we know that breastfeeding seems to be protective with weight issues later. And I think one of the, you know, people have said, oh, it's because kids taste different things in their mother's milk, and which is very true too, probably. Yeah. And there's probably also some hormonal things going on. But, you know, when you think about breastfeeding, you don't know how much they've taken. They pull off when they've quit eating. And, you know, with a bottle, you kind of get the feeling like, you know, it starts at a very early age, like, oh, you're a 4-ounce baby now. You're a 6-ounce baby now. So yeah, you should take 6 ounces. Oh, you didn't take very much. You didn't finish your old bottle. Let's finish the whole bottle. Whereas if you're breastfeeding, it's like, oh, they came off. I have no idea how much they took.
That's true. I never really thought about that. That's true.
No clue. And so I think, you know, early on, you know, and not for, you know, I think the lesson from that is we need to carry that over into our other things that we eat. It's like when you're finished, you're finished. We eat slowly. We eat at a regular time. We eat as part of a social activity. when we can. Life is crazy, and a lot of times it's a drive-through meal, but we try to do our best at making it a sit-down meal in the same place at the same time. But, and you let kids sort of determine when they're full. We don't want to override that innate, as you said, that innate full meter. Like, okay, I'm done. I shouldn't force myself through it.
And I do respect certain cultures and, of course, waste and so on. So what I try to counsel my families is don't put as much on the plate then. And
Right.
That's another thing. When kids see so much on the plate, it can be overwhelming. I try to remind them, have you ever gone to a restaurant and you get this huge plate with all this food? And sometimes you're like, whoa, I'm not going to be able to finish this. Kids feel the same way. So don't be afraid to put a little less and then celebrate, you know, when they do finish. And if they want more, they can always have more.
Well, you know, and that's a great strategy that we always, when I worked in the weight management center at Cincinnati, that was a strategy we always saw. And really in general practice, we always talked about that. I always talked about that with families and patients who were trying to adjust their weight status, you know, whether, you know, they were trying to get into a healthier zone. I said, you know, like make a serving, eat it, wait a couple minutes. If you're still hungry, go get more. You're growing. If you're hungry, you go get more. But, you know, it's that thing that our bodies are about 20 minutes behind. Our stomach is about, our head is about 20 minutes behind our stomach. Like we know we're full, but our brain is keeps telling us eat, 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 eat. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I'm overly full. So, you know, I think that's a really common reaction, especially amongst those of us who are physicians who are notoriously fast eaters, because we're like, oh my gosh, you know, our 10-minute lunches. So we overeat because our brain hasn't gotten a chance to register yet. So we're never about like, you must be hungry. If you're hungry, kids should eat. But if they're not hungry, they shouldn't. And sometimes slowing down really helps them realize, am I really hungry or am I just still having that hangover from being hungry before I started?
This is a great shift into, let's talk more about prevention. So slowing down. You also mentioned meals together. What are some other really powerful, doable things that families can do at home to support that healthy weight and growth?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is really critical for nutrition, and again, we're talking about healthy, active living, right? It's not just weight. We're talking about what is really healthy. Well, what we know is that kids at a very early age really start losing fruits and vegetables in their diet. Huh. And I think that we have to always keep our eye on the ball with that. You know, I think if you're having pizza, you've always got a salad with it. You've always got a fruit and vegetables. We have to think about them first. They take a little bit more time to prepare. They take a little bit more time. And I'm talking a little bit more time, not a lot more time, but we need to get fruits and vegetables first up in our mindset. You know, we all know what we want to have for dessert or what the main course is or the mac and cheese, but we need to really get those fruits and vegetables front and center. They need to be the first thing you see. They need to make it the majority of the plate. And I think that's something that we really know that, is important because they're not as calorie dense. And that also leads into other things too. It's like, you know, like really making sure that we've got water there. A lot of times we confuse thirst with, hunger. And so, you know, we think we're hungry when really what we are is we're thirsty. So it, you know, keeping water front and center, keeping those things that are not calorie dense right in front of us from the get-go is really important.
What are your thoughts about intuitive eating? I've heard that expression. I know parents have too, where they, can we trust children to just eat what they know is right for them?
Yeah, I think, you know, the line that I always like, I don't know if you're familiar with the stuff that Ellen Satter does.
I'm not.
She's great. She has a book from many years ago called Child of Mine. I always recommend it to my families are like, who really want that big, long book on this. I always say read Child of Mine by Ellen Satter. It's a great book. And she always, she's the author of the line, "Parents provide, children decide."
Oh, I know that line. I didn't realize it came from her.
Yeah, that's her. That's her. And so she's, you know, she always says that you provide the what and the when, and kids do the how much. So, you know, you decide when mealtime is, where it's going to be eaten, in what kind of setting, and what's on that plate. And then they decide what of it that they're going to eat.
That is, I say that all the time. So now I know where it comes from. What about the role of routine and modeling with, like, how can parents talk about food that and their own bodies that promotes that health without instilling that guilt and anxiety? I know we brought up some of it, but let's talk about modeling, because I know sometimes it's hard. I had a mom who said, you know, well, I like having the sweets around or things like that. So what can we do to help in that case too? Because I know it's hard.
So there were a lot of things that I learned when I first started doing obesity work over 20 years ago. And actually, it's been longer than that, because I did a little bit of it in fellowship way back in the early 90s. But, you know, one of the very first things that I learned, and you brought this up, the importance of habit, the importance of consistency, of routines. That is really, really good stuff. And especially for our patients who are struggling with weight, the more routine that you can get them. So I want to go back to the modeling thing, definitely, because that's really important. But I think that you mentioned something that is really important in weight management, is the importance of routine. You know what? Decision-making is terrible when you're hungry. It's terrible when you go to the grocery store when you're hungry. We know that. It's, you know, and the restaurant menu is loaded for impulse buying. That's totally what it's designed for. They want you to do that. That's why candy is at the checkout aisle, and why the appetizers and dessert. Look, take a look at the dessert menu before we even get started. Here's our dessert case as you're walking in the door. So, you know, I think that routine is really important. So the more you can take the decision-making out of it. And this goes down to things like not thinking about snacking as, hey, what's available, but thinking of snacking as a planned miniature meal. I'm going to have a snack. It is going to be peanut butter on celery at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, so it's going to be a very specific, it's very planned. So the decision-making is taken out. If lunch looks the same way every day, but it's something you like, more power to you. You know, like we all talk about, oh, it should be very variety. It should have a lot of big variety. Yeah, that's true over the long haul. But you know what? It's not survival strategies. If this is something that works for you at lunch, like I had to be at work. I don't know if you're this way. I basically the same thing every day at lunch, because I was like, I cannot be faced with decision-making at a fast food or a fast casual place. I'll eat a cinnamon crunch bagel before I even realize something happened, you know, like,
yeah.
So anyway, but then also too, like your comment about patterning, you know, just like you said, like kids remember what their parents say to them. Mm-hmm. They also remember what we do. And I think that it is critical that we show that we're trying. I had one of the cutest, daycare providers once. She was a lovely person. I did a lot of work in reaching out to childcare groups. And her comment to me was, "Dr. Bowling, I struggle with weight myself." She had severe obesity, and she was a childcare provider. And she said, I just sit here," and she said, "how can I tell these kids to do all these good habits when I am struggling myself?" And I said to her, I said, "you know what?" I said, I wish I was the one who said this. One of my colleagues kind of chimed in and said, "you know, I don't want to take advice from a person who clearly never struggles with things. Like, they don't understand me. But if I see you drinking water and giving up soda, or I see you eating your fruits and vegetables first, I'm like, she's trying too." And I'm like, you know, that is really absolutely correct. It's like they are You know, you want to see it from people who are also struggling. Like I, as someone who's always struggled with weight myself, like not to be crass about it, but the last thing I want is a skinny person telling me how I should look. You know, I want somebody who feels my pain, right? You know, I want someone who really knows what it's like to struggle.
I mean, I hate to use the word thin because I know we're really trying to use language so that it's more healthy. But when I feel the same sometimes when, you know, it's that, what do they call that? Imposter syndrome, right? Because we don't want to have that, you know, we're telling them how to live a healthy life. And yet, you know, I sit there too with my own weight, but I tell them, I just want you to know that it is hard. And I think that even small changes make such a difference. And let's really be in tune to how our bodies feel when we eat certain things, when we move, when we get a good night's sleep, right, when we spend time together, instead of looking at that number, which I'd like to bring up. I try to tell families that number on the scale, like you said, the BMI is like a vital sign. It's just data. It's just data. We just use it for data. It's just another sign. But how do you feel after you've taken a nice walk? How do you feel after you've eaten those fruits and vegetables? And I think if we can focus on how we feel when we do these changes, that, and what does healthy and happy feel like?
Right. I think you get to know your body. You know, you really get to understand, like, now I know if I don't get enough water, or now I know if I haven't been able to exercise for a few days, I really feel it. And I think that, you know, we want kids to be able to have that sensation of what that really feels like.
Now, I know that you were co-author of the AAP guidelines. What are some of the key takeaways from those guidelines that you would like to share for the families?
I think there are some really key guidelines in there. So, and I think it's important for families to know how their pediatricians are interpreting this, mm-hmm. because it's as you know, we've really been working with pediatricians to help understand this document because it's complicated and big and there's a lot in there. Mm-hmm. But we can boil it down to some really big key points, I think. Number one, your pediatrician is going to use BMI to help direct more of a workup. So they will look based on BMI, based on family history, based on risk factors, your pediatrician will at times suggest that you do some blood work or some other assessments for how weight might be affecting your health. And what I'm talking about is they're going to watch blood pressure closely. They may check liver function. They may check carbohydrate metabolism, so how you metabolize sugars and starches. And they may also look at your lipid profile. They may look at how, you know, what's happening with cholesterol, good and bad cholesterol. They're also going to be very diligent about taking, measurements and assessments of other things that weight might be causing, like orthopedic issues, neurologic mm-hmm. issues, behavioral health issues, how it might be impacting. The other thing that is really, really important on the assessment side that I would say for pediatricians that we really try to hammer home is the elimination of weight bias and weight stigma in the office. You should not be made to feel bad about your weight. You should not be made to be shamed about it. We really are trying to help pediatricians and care providers talk about weight in a constructive way. Like hopefully we're talking about it today, hopefully. Then when it comes down to that's sort of the assessment side of things. So what about the treatment side of things? What does it really say in there? Well, number one, it says, don't wait. Don't just sit there and say, oh, this is going to get better. Oh, you're big boned. Oh, it's blah, blah, blah. No, talk about it. Talk about it where it is now. Talk about what it might mean now, what it might mean later. But watchful waiting is kind of a thing of the past. We mm-hmm. don't, you know, if we see somebody going toward, you know, high blood pressure or mental illness or cancer, we don't watchful wait. We know that things can go badly. So, you know, the watchful waiting is not something that is encouraged. It also says that, you know, the document also talks about when to involve what we kind of call the three pillars of weight management strategies. And that's one is called intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment. IHBLT for short. And IHBLT is this lifestyle treatment where you do with sort of intensive nutrition counseling, exercise counseling, where we use that motivational interviewing stuff in more detail.
Okay.
The second one is for patients that are experiencing severe obesity to talk about, not to prescribe it, not to say you need to go do this right away, but to present the options of bariatric surgery and medication therapy. So it's those two things where, you know, the guidelines were basically, and that's what all the, you know, the press picked up on right away was that stuff. And I have to admit, when it came back from our data reviewers to the writing group, that this is what the data is showing, that we need to be offering this as an option sooner, we were all dumbfounded, honestly. I shouldn't say dumbfounded. We kind of knew. I mean, we know the literature too, but we were able to make a pretty strong statement saying that, like, you're not forcing people onto this. And I think some people said that meant like everybody who's in this range should be on these medications. That's not at all what I was saying. But what it was saying was you need to talk about it early rather than late with patients who qualify. So I would say those are the big points from that document.
I'm going to circle back, and I did want to ask a question. And that is, can you talk about the variety of causes and variables that lead to obesity in children? You mentioned the genetics, but I'm talking about like emotional and psychological factors that can significantly contribute. You know, there's stressful life events that lead to overeating and weight gain, coping mechanisms, family problems, like all that, self-esteem. It's how mental health really does play a role.
Well, those of us who are in the world of obesity, I describe us as we're chaos lovers, because we are people that, you know, like trying to bring order out of chaos, because this is such a complicated zone. Just like there's so many different complications from obesity, there is so many different causes for it. And that's why we have so much to learn. There's so much research that needs to be done. There's so many good studies out there that need to continue to get funding, that need to really continue on, so we learn more about this very, very complicated topic. But it really is a whole host of things that factor in on that complexity scale. The beginning part, the causes of obesity are extraordinarily complicated. We know that there are genetic factors that affect your hormonal regulation, that affect sleep, which then affect weight, that then affect appetite control. So genetically, and there are certain, not only are there certain specific genetic issues, deletions, additions that can cause people to not regulate appetite appropriately, there are a lot of multigenic sort of causes that will set people up for it. So that's one part, your innate genetics.
Okay.
The second piece is, you know, what happened during uterine development? Like what was the milieu there that may have triggered things? And then we talk about, you know, what are your other personal sorts of things that may set you up for it? Are there certain factors in your personality type or other things, or, you know, are you suffering from depression or anxiety? And is food or exercise somehow factoring into that? And then we talk about family dynamics that can trigger it. We talk about, you know, the environment that you're set up in. You know, I look at some of the places that in our bigger cities that, you know, you just, there's not access to good food. You know, being a Kentuckian, Eastern Kentucky is the highest per capita, one of the highest per capita presences of fast food and one of the lowest per capita presences of grocery stores in the country. So that's a setup.
Yeah,
I mean, Southeastern Ohio is the same way. It's a setup for not having access to healthy foods. But then there's also other factors too. It's not just fast food. There's lots of other things that trigger it as well. And then there's you know, the school environment that has an impact. There's the community environment that has an impact. There's state policy. There's food availability. There's SNAP availability. there's all sorts of things. There's corn policy. There's all sorts of things that factor into, you know, what triggers these issues.
Yeah, it's so complex, isn't it? And then we add social media. What are thoughts about that relationship and weight? Sometimes, I mean, I work with the American Academy of Pediatrics to help change the message around that. But one thing that I try to help with families is when they're on electronics, what are they not doing? What is it crowding out? Is it crowding out sleep, which we know affects weight? Is it crowding out intentional movement, which, you know, getting their bodies moving? Is it crowding out time with family? And so all of those things can be factors as well.
Oh, absolutely. So there's definitely that crowding effect, and not to go back to it all the time, but I do worry that, you know, social media, because of the body types that are portrayed there. Mm-hmm. Actually, and, you know, eating disorders really are a different thing. They're very different. They're a very specific issue that needs to be treated. You can't treat a eating disorder we can avoid weight stigma and weight bias by using motivational interviewing. You can't treat an eating disorder with motivational interviewing. It needs very specific treatment and very specific high level aggressive treatment. It's a very different kind of thing. However, we really get a lot of body distortion and body image things when people are, you know, seeing the latest diet trend and the latest, this is the way you're supposed to look. And I just think it's a hive for promotion of an unreasonable body image.
So true. We went from 17 magazine, right? And magazines. And now it's, we're seeing the influencers and so on. Well, Dr. Yeah. Boland, thank you for your insight and your decades of dedication to helping families and pediatricians understand and address childhood obesity with compassion, clarity, and science. As you shared today, this isn't about perfection. It's about creating environments where our kids can thrive physically and emotionally, being happy and healthy, like you said. But before we wrap up, if there's one small shift or mindset you hope parents take away from today's conversation, what would it be?
You know, I think you sort of alluded to it. I think parents need to, number one, give themselves some grace, but also embrace that role as a role model. You know, all you can do is your best. All you can do is to try to live what you preach. And, you know, just to get out there with your kids on a walk and eat healthy with them, that has so much power down the line.
And for those who want to learn more, we'll include links about the AAP guidelines and additional resources. Thank you again, Dr. Boland. And to our listeners, remember, you're not alone on this journey. Every step towards health is a step worth taking. Until next time, be well, and let's keep growing up together.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.